Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. What happens to a young person who has an early interaction with the law that lands him or her in a detention facility of one sort or another? Does society seem to want to give them another chance or lock them up and throw away their futures? Our guest immersed himself in their world in search of answers. Join him and me today here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Jeff Hobbs. He's written a new book called Children of the State, Stories of Survival and Hope in the Juvenile Justice System. And of course, you wrote another book some time back called The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, that won an award and recognized as a really important piece of reporting about someone you knew and cared about deeply. How much did that book inform this book?
Oh, thanks for mentioning Rob Peace, which obviously was a very personal story. And it's a good question, actually, because the one almost directly led into the other in the sense that I was invited to speak at a few different juvenile halls, which is what Children of the State is about. Over time, connecting with young people who were in bad trouble and in peak crisis in their lives, going to classrooms and connecting with young people over the story of Rob Peace in a few different ways, it sort of got me started on this work, Children of the State.
Just remind people about Robert Peace.
Yeah, so Rob was my college roommate for 4 years and my best friend in college at Yale. This was, we were in the class of 2002, so getting on in years now. Doesn't feel like that long ago, actually. And Rob grew up the hard way in Newark, New Jersey. His father was in prison for murder, and his mom worked really hard for not very much money. And he just through hard work and a lot of help from others, he went to Yale and then majored in molecular biophysics and biochemistry, which is about as hard as it sounds. And then he graduated college and he did what a lot of people in his life told him not to do. He went back home and he taught high school and took care of his mother and did a lot of noble things, but he made a couple bad decisions involving marijuana and particularly selling it in places that were a lot more dangerous to sell it than a Yale dorm room, and he died violently.
Well, it's ironic because I don't live too far from Yale University, and on my way between where I live and just down the road at Yale, there now is a legal dispensary selling marijuana. So, you go. Yeah, it's
And in fact, I'm teaching at Yale this semester, and so I was just there yesterday, and I was running on the New Haven Green, and there were a few people puffing away.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you then went on as a result of doing some speaking about that book. And what interested you about getting inside the juvenile justice system, these institutions set up for young people? And you've got to define for us the types of institutions that we're going to be talking about, because you have three separate looks inside. You spent many months immersive reporting on these things. What is this kind of facility like, and who are the young people who are there?
The pull really was just these kids, these individual kids and their teachers whom I met over time. And I remember the first time I went to a juvenile hall to formally speak to a classroom, I didn't get to speak because before the class started, there was a big fight. Just one kid attacked another kid over something, and multiple guards came and walkie-talkies lit up and doors slammed, and they had to close the whole school for the rest of the day. And I tell that story because if you go spend an hour in a juvenile hall, and I'll talk about the different kinds of facilities, but if you go for a short time, it feels pretty much exactly what you would expect a jail for kids to feel like. It is chaotic, it's loud, people are angry, people are fighting, arguing, kids versus adults, kids versus kids, adults versus adults sometimes, and it's just peak crisis. But what happened after that fight is I asked permission, but I just wrote to each of the kids who fought like a little letter saying, I don't know, I hope you guys are all right, and I'm sorry we didn't do the class. And they both wrote back just about their lives a little bit. It was funny because the kid who started the fight said, man, I was so looking forward to this class. I'd never met an author before. And I was thinking, well, it didn't seem like you were looking forward to it that much. But all to say that if you go for an hour, it's one thing. If you go and stay and connect with people and pay attention to the school part, because these facilities are schools and kids go to math and English, then it starts to feel different and started to feel to me worth exploring.
Well, let me ask you, the system itself and the young people we're talking about, just so someone listening really understands, because we have a case, as you know, right now pending in America of a six-year-old child who went into his classroom somehow with a gun and shot his teacher. He's 6 years old, and everyone's kind of throwing up their hands. Well, what do you do with a child like this, and who's responsible for that behavior? How old are we talking about these kids being in general who end up in this part of the system?
So it varies, and yeah, I mean, that case we can talk about if you'd like, but I'm writing in Children of the State about older kids, teenagers, and it varies because one thing about the juvenile justice system that makes it so impenetrable is that it's locally governed. So each state and actually different counties and different city districts all have different rules for the age limitations and how young or old kids can be. So there is a range. I mean, I met kids as young as 12 and 13 along the way, and kids as old as 20 and 21 who are not really kids anymore. And they're all in these small spaces and classrooms. But for the most part in this book, we were talking about high school aged students, 15, 16, 17 years old. Some of them had hurt people really bad, some of whom had maybe just stolen something or gotten in a fight, some of whom had killed people.
And when did most of them begin their intersection with the criminal justice system in America? When did they become noticed, if you will, for some action on their part?
Point of writing a book, which again is three stories, just because the system in the world felt so big. I would say where I was mostly in big city, New York, a medium city, San Francisco, and a small city, Wilmington, Delaware. Yeah, these kids start having contact young. I mean, usually through school, truancy, school resource officers, again, fighting, not as much drugs as a lot of people suspect, and a lot of them starting very young because maybe parents had been in the system. And that was actually a really tragic pattern that emerged, was how many kids just were familiar with jail from a very young age, just from family.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just such a heartbreaking thing. And for you, I know you write this from your heart and to inspire readers to do something, to volunteer, to advocate, to at least care about these kids, because we are not, at this moment, as best I can tell, the most compassionate society. We've got a lot of angry people out there who would say to you, well, why should I care? You know, I mean, these kids did bad things and they should be locked away. Having said that, you know, we've worked so hard in other cases to deinstitutionalize other people who were ostracized from our society for either just who they were genetically or who they became over time. And yet I'm wondering, do you think we have even begun the process of figuring out what to do with this still a salvageable young person in most cases?
It's really the undercurrent of this book is just what to do with young people who have made bad choices. And I want to be clear, I'm not excusing bad choices or sort of saying like everybody should be sent to daycare or something, not to be trite, but it's such a complex issue that sometimes the answers thrown around can start to sound like that. But one thing I did for this book was that was really fascinating and troubling was a pretty deep dive into the history of the system. I mean, going back hundreds of years, there's a lot of details that I'll gloss over. What the system has always done and what it continues to do with a lot of kids, I mean, it's still 250,000 kids a year who are locked up, even if only for an afternoon. It still changes your life. But the system has always kind of shunted kids that are hard to deal with away from our view and into these facilities that tend to be kind of removed from our daily commutes and kind of set back from the street and very nondescript. And that's intentional. They're put in places where we don't really have to think about them. And as I sort of intimated before, a lot of these kids didn't do anything that bad. I met a girl who was in a fight, and I mean, I fact check everything. It's important to say with resource officers and probation and the courts and everything. So I do double check everybody's stories just as part of being a journalist. But a girl who in a fight at school, her shoe came off and she was pinned down and she used the shoe to kind of slap someone off her, and she was charged in court with assault with a weapon, things like that. And it diffuses the support that the kids who did make bad decisions and did bad things.
What kind of representation do these young people have when they are then embroiled in a situation that might lead them into one of these facilities? Do they really generally have adults who are really advocating for them? Do they have lawyers? What kind of representation do they have before they end up here?
Yeah, it's another really good point. And it's one of, when I mentioned some of the history here is very troubling and is worth our attention. I mean, I know the numbers are not huge. Being in jail changes kids, and it's the psychology of locks becomes dooming. And I do want to separate the system from the people working inside the system who tend to be, from my experience, compassionate and, I mean, tired for sure, but invested and doing hard things in terrible situations. But the way the system works is there are a lot of steps between being arrested and being sent to detention for a kid. And again, it varies state by state and county by county, but roughly 6 or 7 or 8 legal decisions that have to be made before a judge makes that final decision to incarcerate a teenager. Mm. And if you have an adult show up for you, a parent, an advocate, an attorney with money to pay fines and backing you up, at any one of those decision points, if you have real representation, you don't go to jail. I mean, unless gun violence really hurting someone.
Do these young people see it as jail?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, words are very important here because I say jail because I spent a lot of time in different places and different levels of security. The kids say jail, just if they're if the door's locked and they can't go outside, they call it jail. Different court systems and offices call it different things. They call it state care. They call it residence. They don't really call it detention anymore. So the kids call it jail, and you can okay. make of that what you want to.
And on average, how long do kids stay there? And when they get out, I mean, obviously, we have such a problem with older people who end up in prison. And when they get out, the services that are meant to be a glide path for them are so spotty across the country. What happens to a child once they are, after having all this psychology of the jailing process thrown at them at a very young age, and then they're released? How have you been able to follow them? I know it hasn't been a long period of time, and a lot of your work got caught up in the pandemic, and it was a complicated project for you because of the way you immerse yourself for many months. But do you generally, historically, know what happens to a young person upon release?
Yeah, and it was complicated, and this sort of work, it changes shapes, and you just sort of go where people go. And so I was in the facility in Delaware, was an actual detention facility where kids who'd sent there by the court are there for 3, 6, 9 months, or generally a year at most. So they've been sentenced by the court. The facility in San Francisco where I was actually like a holding, sort of like the juvenile equivalent of a county jail. So they'd been arrested, but not yet adjudicated. So they were there for, again, maybe an afternoon for more complicated arrests. They could be in there a couple months. So there was a huge range of time spent, and also just the psychologies and stresses that they were dealing with. But I do stay with people after they got out, and the recidivism with kids is higher even than adults. It's over 80% when you sort of add up all the different states and jurisdictions. The data's hard because of the way it's all
right.
situated. And I mean, a part of it is home and influences and friends and that kind of hopelessness. I tried to explain that psychology of locks. But then another part is the gaps that happen in education. And even if you're gone for a month, if you miss that month of school and you're not keeping up with it while you're away, then it's pretty hard to go back to school. It's hard for schools to accept kids who have records. There's a lot of, there's just so much friction with reentry for kids. And that's
yeah.
part of the hopelessness. The kids who do the best are the ones who come out of state care programs that are very focused really at all costs on giving these kids credits, just keeping them on track in high school. And actually one of the kids who spent 2 years in detention, he's really the main character of Children of the State, my book. He was, when you add it all up, he was inside for almost 2 years. And because of that, he ended up graduating from high school while he was in a facility.
Children of the State, Stories of Survival and Hope, in the juvenile justice system. The author, a person who really gets into his subject in a way that is so personal and intimate, you really begin to know people like Ian Alvaro and others like Alex Griffin, and you get to know, you know, teachers, you get to know the young people themselves, and you do focus on different kinds of programs, of course. The final section, where you focus on Exalt Youth in New York, they attempt to keep kids out of detention. They go to their own high school. How reflective is this of some of the innovation that is going on across the country in different places, as you say, because it's very individualized, county by county, state by state. But how much have you seen reform as part of what you are hoping will bring us better results going forward?
It's reform, but really what it boils down to, what in my experience, is just support. And this group you mentioned, Exalt, it's a very intensive diversion program in New York City for kids who've had contact with the justice system and generally have spent time in juvenile hall. And I mean, New York's juvenile justice system was pretty arcane until very recently. They were sending kids to Rikers Island up through 2017. And Exalt, in classes of about 15 to 20 kids, it's this very intense 4-month program. And they go to school, regular high school, in their neighborhoods and boroughs during the day. And then they get themselves to these classrooms with teachers like Alex, not just to learn sort of life skills and professional skills. And it's not condescending. It's like they practice job interviews. They real skills that are hard for everybody. They get real practice in, but they also connect with each other. So, and then they do a 2-month internship at real companies, lawyers, offices, real estate, schools. If you boil it all down, it's putting intense challenges in front of the kids while also offering them very intense support. You know, people talk about reform, and in San Francisco, for instance, where I was, there was a big motion to just shut down the whole system and reimagine it in really nice spaces. But it felt like they got so bogged down in the idea of reform and what the space would look like that it can be forgotten that it's just support. And with kids, it's just connecting, like having someone looking them in the eye all day. Wherever that happens, I feel like that needs to be the most important thing we think about when we think about redemption for these kids.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to give up on a youngster, and you spent enough time with a number of these youngsters where you must have at times been frustrated because they may not have been open to you. There they are in primarily brown and black skin, you a white guy from outside. I don't know how difficult it was for them to relate to you and to accept you and for you to be able to really understand who they were and be able to report on them. How difficult was that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this conversation is about systems and facilities, but the work that I do is really just about people, particularly young people and the adults working really hard in really hard conditions to shepherd them through. And I'm hanging around these facilities. I work hard to get access and keep that all above board. And you're right, I'm just kind of a middle-aged white guy hanging around their classrooms. But if you hang around enough, and my daughter asked me this once, she was maybe 10 at the time. She said, I mean, the way you talk, these kids can't like you very much, do they? And I said, they might not like me very much or what I look like. People do like to be listened to, and I don't have a lot of talents in life, but I'm a pretty good listener. And so at the end of a long day, when everyone's sort of in their last class, their last class was called RTI. Generally, it's response to intervention, and it's just sort of like a study hall almost. And that's when sort of groups would sit, and I would just ask kind of, how are you feeling? How was today? And people do like that conduit to just to tell their own stories.
You don't like to suggest that because of your ability to listen and to look and observe, that necessarily that makes you more expert, let's say, than others who may not have had the same look-see as you have, though I think it does a lot. And you're reluctant, I think, to provide a lot of solutions, but you do believe that state-funded programs that could guarantee vocational training and jobs for graduating students would help these children. So, and they are children. And I'm wondering, again, you know, whether you want to offer more solutions and whether you think, and this is somewhat unrelated, but whether the brain research that's been going on in this recent period that describes the maturity as being a little more elongated than we used to think, is that being taken into account? The development of this young person, and that they're not their whole self yet, and we don't want them to stop here by virtue of what the system itself then thinks of them.
I mean, the brain research has been unfolding for generations, really. I mean, I think by the turn of the century, scientists were talking about, and the Juvenile Court was founded in 1899, partly based on early research and development, just that kids are not adults, and scientifically it's not working the way adults work. And I think big picture, everybody pays attention to that and wants to factor that in. I think that gets the closer and closer you get into classrooms that are chaotic, the harder it is to sort of use the overview science and developmental science. Again, like the first story I told here, when two kids are fighting, really fighting over whatever, in the middle of a classroom, it's hard to manage that. It's hard to keep the classroom open. And so the people in there doing the work, the counselors, the guards, the teachers, everything is very immediate. I mean, no matter how humane and schooled in developmental science a lot of these teachers are, and special education and mental health, in the chaos of these buildings, a lot of it is just reacting.
Well, I know people who've been substitute teachers in a regular classroom environment, say in an urban area here in Connecticut, and they've come out feeling, you know, that there was no hope for some of the kids. And that's from a regular school environment. What's the ceiling in your mind? Do you still feel, I mean, that the ceiling is as high as we would think for kids who are coming out of better situations? Or do you think the ceiling has to be limited to getting some kind of job and being independent? Or what's your feeling after having gone through this experience? Because you're changed as a result of this, I would imagine, too.
I changed from my work, and that's kind of you. The ceiling is lower. And at the end of this book, I mean, with some sadness, I wrote in the epilogue that I mean, the kids I followed who were the main characters, who really put themselves forward and courageously shared, I mean, all their shortcomings and hardships in life, and also all their small joys and the wonder of being a kid and not being totally young anymore, but definitely not being old or wise, and that just ephemeral moment that they're all in, which is always important to me to capture. I mean, one of these kids had the opportunity to go to college, and the other had the opportunity to graduate from a pretty prestigious program, Exalt, that I mentioned, and neither of them were able to follow through on that. Josiah, who went to college, the only college available to him was in the middle of New York State. It was far from home. It was the middle of winter, because that's when he got out. It was the pandemic, so not as many kids around, and he got lonely and homesick and went home, and I can kind of understand that. Ian in the Exalt program was more frustrating because I felt like he could have followed through for another 6 weeks or whatever it was, and at least finished the program. So, you know, these are bright kids with potential, but they do lose a lot of hope. And despite the subtitle of the book, hope is a very tricky word. But what both of them, I mean, hope is like an orientation of the spirit. It doesn't necessarily mean if you do things one way, a kid's going to graduate college and, you know, achieve the traditional version of a successful life. Part of hope is just the ability to carry on in the face of hope's absence. At the end of it, I mean, both of these kids have done that, and neither has gotten in trouble again, and both are taking care of themselves. I do argue that considering what they had been through and being locked up at a very young age, I thought, and the support and lack thereof available, I thought those are pretty spectacular outcomes.
When you look at it, the U.S. Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention said that the number of incarcerated youth declined 77% from 2000 to 2020. Now, we're talking here about 250,000. So if you extrapolate those numbers, you see that we've got a lot of other kids who may not be incarcerated. They're out there, but and they're not in a jail, and they don't have that piece that kind of can seem overwhelming psychologically when you reflect on it, or you have dreams about it or nightmares. But the question is, there are a lot of kids out there hopeless, aimless. Do you intend to continue studying young people and what they're going through, whether they're inside or outside of an institution, and yet they may be on the verge of some difficulties?
I do, and work started with the story of Rob Peace. I wrote a book about kids in high school in different spaces applying to college, first-generation kids, and I've written Children of the State. Continuing, I'm actually writing about the houseless children in Los Angeles, on the topic of going to school and families just trying to keep themselves together.
Well, give us an early glimpse into what you're seeing there.
I mean, I live in Los Angeles, and maybe you've read some about the houseless situation there over the last few years in particular. I'm writing about a particular family, a mother with five and then six children who for 2 years didn't have a home, but they had a car, and she was working the whole time, and her kids were going to school the whole time. So I'm writing about sort of a sliver of that population that are really just a couple paychecks removed from having a home, but also a car breakdown or a health crisis from being completely destitute and just the, similar to Children of the State, just the immense power of the spirit that people have that, even when things aren't working out the way they are told it will or thought it might, just people's ability to carry on.
Well, Jeff Hobbs, look, I hope that you will continue to force us to look and not look away. And your work does that. Children of the State, Stories of Survival and Hope in the Juvenile Justice System. Tough stuff. And you're the guy who really does know how to unpack it for us. Thank you so much for being with us today here on America Trends.
Thanks so much for having me in this time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.